So sexy, so soon.
When little children are exposed to these graphic messages about sex, and often pornographic messages, they can't process them the way that adults can.
That's Jean Kilbourn talking about America's market-driven sexualization of childhood.
I hope each book I write can be a testament to the fact that I believed in one, our innate human potential, and two, our capacity to love and understand each other despite differences.
And that's Matthew Aaron Goodman. We talked to him about his terrific debut novel, Hold Love Strong. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's cognitive dissonance. On the one hand, we live in a society that gets hysterical about teaching sex education to high school students. On the other, it allows kids as young as preschool age to be targeted by a marketing industry selling products soaked in sex and violence. It's sexy clothes and Bratz dolls for girls. It's Grand Theft Auto video games and other violent fare for boys. Our kids are being taught to treat themselves and others as objects to be exploited and conquered. One could almost call it a kind of child abuse that pervades our culture, but is seldom questioned. My guest, media critic Jean Kilbourn, has been questioning the impact of advertising on our society for a long time. Her film series, Killing Us Softly, examined advertising's image of women. Other films looked at alcohol and tobacco advertising. Her book, Can't Buy My Love, explored how advertising changes the way we think and feel. Now, with her co-author, Diane E. Levin, Dr. Kilbourn's come out with So Sexy So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood, and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. I started out by asking her to read a passage from the book about a young man of 13 named Matt.
One fine spring afternoon, 15-year-old Matt burst onto the street with a sawed-off shotgun just as the friendly neighborhood cop was riding by on his bicycle. Matt shot the cop, commandeered the bike, broke out his Glock, and streaked down the street firing indiscriminately at passersby. In the chaos, a car exploded, flinging a flaming construction worker across the street. Matt decided to ditch the bike. Blowing away the driver of a car with his shotgun, he dragged him onto the sidewalk and peeled off in the car. He spotted a young woman in a very short skirt on the side of the road and ordered her to get in. He drove her to a remote spot and had intercourse with her in the back seat of the car. When he was finished with her, he dragged her out of the car and stomped her to death, feeling himself get hard again as he watched her die. Then his mother ruined everything by calling up the stairs and asking him to set the table.
And what was Matt doing?
Well, as I go on to say, Matt was playing Grand Theft Auto, one of the most popular video games of all time, a game so socially acceptable and widely known that Coca-Cola did a commercial based on an imitation of it. Millions of teenage boys while away hours every day playing this game and others of its ilk, and then they go to school where they encounter lots of girls wearing very short skirts.
That's right. And at the same time that he was playing Grand Theft Auto, his sister... and tell us her age also, was doing something, let's say, on the feminine side of things here.
While Matt was on his murderous spree, his 13-year-old sister, Lizzie, was lying on her bed reading Cosmopolitan. She was learning about how to give a great blowjob. Her best friend, Rachel, had gone to a party on Saturday night and told Lizzie all about it. The most popular girl in the class had gone down on three of the football players. Lizzie thought it sounded gross, but Rachel said it was cool. Lizzie didn't think she'd know how to do it, and she didn't want to ask Rachel, but she'd found the answer in Cosmo. It did sound gross, though.
Yeah, and it would have sounded pretty gross to me at 13, and at 13, I would have never imagined any of these things in my universe. Of course, that dates me.
Yeah. Me, I know, yeah. I thought French kissing was gross at that age, I think.
I did, too. I couldn't imagine why people would want to do that.
Right.
Now, so you say in this book, and I should say you also have your co-author, Diane Levin, you both say that a revolution is taking place that's harming our kids. What's behind that revolution?
Well, I mean, to get right to the point, commercialism is really behind it, that we feel strongly that the reason that there's so much sexualization of children is not to sell our kids on sex, it's to sell them on shopping. And that kids are more and more the target of marketers Researchers have found that babies at the age of 6 months can recognize corporate logos, and that's the age at which they're starting to target our children. So if you can link sex with shopping, if you can eroticize shopping very early in childhood, you're going to have people lined up at the mall for the rest of their lives.
And why is that? I mean, kids aren't supposed to even be all that interested in sex. I mean, it's not really appropriate. What is behind the charge that sex and violence have?
Well, I guess sex and death are sort of the two most powerful unconscious forces, basically, the life force, the death force. And so sex and violence have always been very charged. They attract our attention. They're scary to little kids and confusing to little kids, but they certainly attract attention. They attract their attention. So that's nothing new. What's really new is the way that marketers harness these very powerful subconscious forces and link them with products and use them to sell us stuff.
So what are some of the implications for our children's development?
Well, the implications are really scary because a couple of things happen. And first of all, we're talking here about very little children. And one of the things that Diane and I felt strongly about when we wrote this book was that we wanted to be very clear that this affects boys as well as girls and that it starts very, very early. Because you hear quite a bit about the sexualization of childhood these days, but almost always when you talk about it, people immediately assume girls, and they immediately assume teenagers or maybe tweens. But this is something that's starting very early, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old. When little children are exposed to these graphic messages about sex, and often pornographic messages, they can't process them the way that adults can. You know, children think differently from adults, and they're developmentally different, and so they can't really process them the way we would. And so this can be very scary and confusing to them, and it also interferes with the very natural process of gradually awakening sexuality, you know, over time, of the kinds of things that children need to be learning in order to be preparing themselves to have healthy sexual relationships as they grow older. So it does two things. It kind of confuses and frightens them in the moment, and it interferes with their much more natural development.
Tell us a little bit more about describe how kids, young children, think about sex, and what is important, what is needed for that kind of healthy sexual development.
Well, I think it's not even so much that little kids think about sex so much as they think about or they experience sexuality. And I think one thing that's important to do sort of at the outset is to make that distinction between sexuality and sexualization, that sexuality is a very important part of being a human being. It's extremely important. It's a great source of joy. It's mostly to be celebrated. Sexualization is about turning people into objects, into things. So sexualization is always bad. It's always harmful, whereas certainly that's not true of sexuality at all. And sometimes it's difficult talking about this topic because people can presume that you're anti-sex or that you're prudish or something, but this has nothing to do with that. This is about, again, about turning people into objects, which sets them up for all kinds of problems, including violence against them. So sexuality is something that ideally and usually sort of develops over time, and it begins with an infant discovering his or her body, you know, and discovering the pleasure that his or her body can bring. Sometimes that's just the entire body, the touch, skin, and all of that. And then a little later, as babies discover their genitals and how exciting they are. And this then would be sort of part of the normal development. Very little children are, of course, curious about their bodies and about other children's bodies, and that's normal, too. And then gradually, you know, this develops over time. They grow older, fall in love, have relationships, and of course, ultimately, one hopes that they're going to grow up to have caring relationships, of which sex is an important part. So, but it should be sort of gradual and age appropriate. And what's happening instead these days is that very tiny children are being blasted with these really pornographic images of sex, and it's everywhere, all around them. Some of it's aimed directly at them, sort of the fashions and the makeovers and all of this sort of thing, and some of it isn't, but it's just part of the popular culture that little children are exposed to because it's absolutely inescapable these days.
We'll talk a little more about how that happens. You know, you say that it's become mainstream to turn kids into cute and sexy objects. What are some of the ways in which you see that? And again, I'm talking about young children because there's a whole other discussion of teens. But, you know, there's the idea that the preteen is now being pushed downward from, say, 11 and 12 down to the very early ages.
Very early ages, so that you see a lot of very little girls these days who are dressed in very sexy clothes. There's no other way to describe it. And some of this is a result of the kind of they're wishing to emulate the celebrities, because a lot of the pop stars and that sort of thing appeal, they themselves may be 15, 16, 17, or even older, but their fan base is much, much younger. So these tiny girls look at these older girls, older young women, and they want to be like them, and they want to dress like them, and they want to learn their moves, and they want to sort of pretend that they are these pop stars. And unfortunately, a lot of people, their parents and other people, think this is cute, and they encourage it. And so then these little girls learn early on that acting in this way brings them a lot of attention, a lot of approval, and so it goes.
And what's the difference between, you know, a little girl dressing up in mommy's clothes and in her shoes and this kind of behavior?
That's a great question, because, of course, I mean, we've all done that, dressed up in our mommy's clothes, and that, too, is a normal part of childhood, little boys stomping around in their father's shoes. But there's a world of difference today, because today the little girl isn't wearing mommy's clothes. She's wearing clothes just like mommy's that fit her, that are made to fit her. So, and actually, there's a kind of strange pressure on women these days to look extremely young and to stay very hot and sexy as we grow older. So sometimes you have mommy, you know, dressing in a way that's, you know, sort of more like a teenager, and the 4-year-old daughter is also dressing in a way that's more like a teenager. They kind of meet in the middle. And so it's very different if a little girl is wearing, you know, something that is made for her, made to fit her, and this is part of her daily life and her wardrobe, versus going into mommy's closet and putting on something that's too big and pretending to be mommy.
So there's really no demarcation. There's no way in which she can claim her own age, her own childhood.
Right, and I hear parents all the time say, it's impossible to go shopping for my daughter who's 6 or 7 or 8 because the clothing is so inappropriate. It's so tight, it's sexy, it's sparkly, it's got slogans on it like juicy or, you know, eye candy or whatever. It's even for very little girls. Major department stores these days are selling thong panties and padded bras for 7-year-olds. So it becomes difficult for parents to find clothing that's really much more appropriate for little girls. And of course, this kind of clothing, it's also important because the appropriate clothing enables little girls to be active. You know, if little girls are wearing high heels, and some of them are, or, you know, constricting clothes, it's much more difficult for them to play and to just be active and to not be constantly thinking about what they're wearing and how they look.
We're talking with Jean Kilbourn about the book she co-authored, So Sexy, So Soon. You say at a certain point in the book that you point to this sexualization of children, talk about how society is so desensitized to this sexualization of kids. And I found it ironic that at the same time, it seems that society can't tolerate affectionate touch between non-parents and children. Let's say a teacher, you know, teachers aren't allowed to hug kids anymore because of the fear of child sexual abuse. So there's a kind of incredible disconnect here.
There's a disconnect in so many ways, Francesca, because there's a huge disconnect because of the ways that we don't allow sex education in our schools. But to address the first point, child sexual abuse, of course, is dreadful, and a whole lot of information has come out about it in recent years about how prevalent it is and how incredibly damaging it is. However, the truth is that close to 90% of all cases of child sexual abuse occur in the home. The most dangerous place for most children, you know, who are in danger at all, is in their own home. So the huge media hype about stranger abuse and the pedophile lurking on the playground, granted, I mean, these people do exist, this certainly does happen, but it's much more dangerous, I think, for children to be taught to be terrified of strangers or terrified of any kind of physical contact with somebody who's like a teacher, and for teachers to be terrified in the same way, that we've overblown this in a way. We haven't paid attention to the extraordinary danger that really does exist for children in their own homes from their parents or from relatives or boyfriends of the mother or whatever, that's where so much of this really occurs. And at the same time, as you say, we protect our children from, you know, from this, God forbid that a teacher should hug a child, we allow them to be assaulted, really, by marketers all the time. And I think that people do, I mean, adults in caregiving positions, of course, have to be aware of the current climate, and little children should be taught about good touch and bad touch and encouraged to, you know, talk about it and to report people and that sort of thing. And that's very important. But, boy, we just really shouldn't be not allowing any kind of physical affection or contact with children, because that, I think, is extraordinarily damaging.
Yes, and do you also feel that the sexualization of little girls feeds a child sex abuse epidemic in some ways?
I think it does, and the way that it does it is it normalizes looking at children in this way. I mean, I have ads in my collection, for example, of really very, very young girls posed in very seductive ways or wearing sexy clothing. And what this does is it sort of makes it seem normal that to look at children in this way. So a pedophile, you know, who's always going to be looking for rationalizations anyway, is going to think, oh, well, this is perfectly normal the way I'm feeling about this child. And secondly, is going to feel she's asking for it, which, of course, is what they always say. She wanted it. She's asking for it. So I do think it normalizes that. And again, where this would happen most isn't with, you know, the stranger on the street. It's going to be with somebody in the home who's going to say, well, look how sexy she is. She must be much more advanced than she seems. And so it sets them up, I think, for very, very harmful situations.
Yeah, and it contaminates the relationship between kids and parents in other ways as well. As you talk about in the book, Jean Kilburn, you talk about in So Sexy, So Soon, that there's a kind of commercial advertisers abetting or even creating of a premature rebellion, adolescent rebellion against parents. What do you mean by that?
Well, advertisers, starting when kids are very young, try to pit children against their parents. They know that children, you know, little children, of course, have no income, and they don't mostly they don't have any sort of real money of their own to spend, but they have tremendous amount of power over their parents. And the advertisers play on this. They actually, in their own literature, refer to what they call the whine factor, W-H-I-N-E, or the nag factor, which is really encouraging children to simply nag their parents to death until they buy them what they want. And this can happen in a grocery store, you know, where all the cereals for children are at the eye level of a four-year-old, or it can happen, you know, with things that are advertised on television and where children are actually encouraged to just whine until they get what they want. Now, obviously, parents should be setting limits, but this certainly makes the parents' job more difficult. And as children grow older, advertisers further encourage this kind of rebellion against parents. And it's not just advertisers. All kinds of movies and TV shows and other aspects of the popular culture portray parents as sort of idiots and fools and as the enemy and as the, you know, the prudes and the people who don't want kids to have any fun. And then the kids become the cool, edgy people who are trying their best to, you know, outsmart their parents and often do in the popular culture. So that it sets up this awful divide between parents and children, which, of course, becomes particularly critical and damaging when kids hit their teenage years, where there is some natural, of course, rebellion anyway, but the advertisers really exacerbate it.
And talk about this particularly in terms of the sexualization of children. You know, we know about it just in terms of, you know, buying toys in general, the nag factor, but how this is all connected in with popularity, with acceptance, and how that intersects with a child's, you know, natural need for acceptance within a group and how they negotiate their social relationships.
Well, I think many parents today feel quite overwhelmed by all these messages, and they really don't want to be giving in all the time, and they don't want to be buying these sexy clothes for their little girls, and they don't want to be encouraging their boys to, you know, act in tough ways and that sort of thing. But they feel like they feel like they can't just be saying no all the time, and of course they don't want their children to be outcast in their social group, and children can make powerful arguments in that regard. You know, well, no one's going to play with me if I don't have, you know, a brass doll, et cetera. And so, and there is, in fact, some truth to that, which is why I think it's so important for parents to support each other, that one of the things we recommend in the book is for is to get to know the parents of your children's friends so that you can find support. When my daughter was little, and this seems like a very tame problem these days, but I didn't want her to wear clothing with logos on it, you know, and it's very hard often these days to find clothing without logos. But I also didn't want her to be the only kid in the school who didn't have an Abercrombie shirt, you know, so I talked with other parents about it, and a small group of us were able to agree on that so that my daughter wasn't the only outcast. There was a little tribe of kids who had unreasonable parents, you know, and that can really be helpful if you get other parents to sort of go along with it, to talk about what your values are and what you, you know, why you feel the way you do, and see if you can get some support and form some alliances. And this will serve you well as your, if your children are teenagers as well. It's kind of a version of calling ahead if your child is a teenager is going to a party to make sure that an adult is home.
One of the wonderful aspects of this book is that you have so many thoughtful ideas to help parents negotiate this dangerous territory of the sexualization of children. You're not against teaching about sex to kids. What is the right way? You have this wonderful example of a father and his young boy in the book. I wonder if you can use some of what happened there in their dialogue to illustrate a sensitive parent's way of teaching their kids about sex.
Well, one of the things we have in the book is samples of actual conversations where we sort of talk about what's said and what's going on, you know, that isn't said. And I think that a lot of people do find that very helpful because sometimes it can be hard to even imagine how to have this conversation with one's kids. And one of the things we do say very strongly is that if we had to say just one thing to parents, it would be have lots of conversations. Start very early on talking with your children about everything, about sex, about sexuality, about your values, about everything. And we don't mean the big talk, you know, the lecture. We mean much more, often very brief conversations, starting where the child is at. So let's say if a child comes to you and is concerned or disturbed about something, you might want to start by, or you always want to start, I think, by being clear what the child, exactly what the child is thinking. And I mean, but let me give you one example from my own life. When my daughter was about 11 several years ago, she said to me, "Mommy, what's oral sex?" And then she said, "I think I know, but I just want to be sure." So I was a little taken aback. I wasn't ready for this, but I said, "Well, honey, what do you think it is?" And she looked at me sort of confidently and said, "I think it's when you talk about it." So I thought that was, first of all, adorable. And I said to her, "Well, sex, you know, communication is a really important part of sex, and that's great." But I didn't leave. I was tempted to leave it at that and to say, "Yes, that's what it is." But of course, I didn't because I didn't want her to have the wrong information and be embarrassed later. So I told her, you know, what it was, and that was that. But I think if I hadn't, it was important that I find out, first of all, what she thought. In the same way that there's a story in the book about a little boy about 5 years old who says to a little girl in his class, "I want to have sex with you." And, of course, the parents all go ballistic, and the little boy's about to be thrown out of school and probably sent into therapy for the rest of his life. And then somebody thinks to ask him what he meant, and he bursts into tears and says, I like her. I wanted to kiss her. He had no idea what it means to say that. I mean, he heard it all around him, but he had no idea. So it was important to figure out where he was at. So one of the conversations in the book is a conversation between Seth, a little boy, and his father, and how they talk about sex. So, I mean, I'll just read just one little beginning of it. "When Seth is 5 years old, seemingly out of the blue, he asks Dave, his father, how do babies get into the mother? Trying to provide just the information Seth is asking for, Dave succinctly says, the father puts a seed in the mother and the baby starts to grow. Oh, replies Seth, and then he walks away. So what's wonderful about that is that the father doesn't give him any more information than he's asking for. He's very factual, he's honest, but he doesn't go on and on and on. He just answers the question. Now, if Seth wanted to know more, and later in the conversation, you know, as he's older, he does, the father tells him more. But what's important is that he gives just the information that he's asking for, and then he stops to see if Seth wants more, and if Seth is satisfied with the answer, then that's fine. And also by his response, Dave, the father, is showing Seth that it's safe to ask grown-ups such questions, that he's establishing an atmosphere in which the child learns that it's always safe to ask a question and that the child will not be shamed or embarrassed or rebuffed, but rather the parent will do his or her best to answer the question. But again, in an age-appropriate, honest, direct way, without giving a ton of information that the child is not asking for and probably isn't ready for. Left to their own, I mean, or in an environment like that, the questions will come and they'll gradually become more more intense, or they'll be seeking more and more information, and that's fine. But what's unfortunately what's happening in our culture today is that children are being overwhelmed with this information long before they can process it.
You also talk in the book about some changes you'd like to see in public policy, and I wondered if you could give us a number of those.
Sure. One of the things that we feel is very important is that this is not entirely up to parents. The parents, of course, have a lot of responsibility, but most parents love their children and do the best they can. And many parents, I think, feel these days that it's incredibly difficult. And it is. And so I actually think that it's more difficult to be a parent these days than probably than it's ever been before. Psychologically, it's incredibly difficult because in the past, throughout human history, parents have, for the most part, been supported by the culture. Not perfectly, but in general, you know, they felt supported. Whereas these days, parents, I think, feel they are opposed by the popular culture every step of the way. And I know raising my daughter, I felt that the popular culture was hostile to everything I wanted for her, and I had to fight back against every single message. I mean, sex, drugs, you name it. My values were different, and I had to sort of keep fighting back, which was exhausting. And ultimately, you're doomed to fail because, as a parent, you can't stem the tide, you know, of all these messages. So that's why we also feel that this is a public health problem and that we need to be creating a society that's going to make parenting easier rather than more difficult. And there are lots of things we could do in that regard and things that other countries are doing. I mean, one obvious thing is to teach sex education in our schools. And that means to teach honest, accurate, age-appropriate sex education starting very early on.
And what would it look like very early on? And how do you make the connection? I mean, one of the things you say in the book, So Sexy, So Soon, is this whole disconnect between love and sex. And I wonder if that's something that you also want to bring into the conversation, including in sex education in the schools.
Absolutely. I mean, we feel that a part of sex education should be education about relationships, about intimacy, about how to be in a relationship, how to deal with conflict, how to communicate. And this, of course, would help people with all kinds of relationships, not just sexual relationships. And this is a part of sex education in many other countries. The United States is the only developed nation in the world that doesn't teach sex education. And the kind of sex education that we have taught traditionally, particularly in the past 8 years, has been this abstinence-only education, which has, I think, done a huge amount of harm because the parts of the country that have most used this have the highest rates of teen pregnancy and of sexually transmitted illnesses. So our kids are paying a very high price for not being given information. Now, I believe in comprehensive sex education, which would include abstinence, of course, as part of it. I think most parents, even if parents don't feel that they want their children to wait until marriage to have sex, certainly most parents want to delay the onset of intercourse, you know, until children are old enough to handle it emotionally and in every other way. But we definitely need to give kids the information they need to protect themselves once they do start having intercourse. And it starts very early on. And, you know, you say that and people think, oh, my God, teaching sex ed in kindergarten, what's next, you know? But that just means in kindergarten, it might just mean teaching about communication and about teasing and bullying and how to deal with conflict and that sort of thing. It could mean some very basic sort of education about the body and how the body works, but, you know, it would be something that would be developmentally appropriate for kids that age. You know, the truth is, you know, we have a very strange culture in that we surround our kids with, you know, we let them be the target of very graphic messages from marketers, but God forbid that we should teach them about sex, you know, in the schools or talk about it even at home. What people say, sometimes people say, oh, sex education, we don't want that. They fail to realize that our kids are getting massive doses of sex education, but they're getting it from the popular culture, and they're getting the kinds of messages about sex that most parents, I think, do not want their kids to get. So we could be countering that, you know, rather than just turning our kids over to the marketers.
Well, Jean Kilburn, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. Your book is So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids, and you co-wrote that with Diane Levin.
Thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Jean Kilburn. To get tips on talking to kids about sex and violence, or to find out how to get involved in fighting the sexualization of childhood, go to writersvoice.net. We've put up links to help you get started. Next up, Hold Love Strong. We talk with the novel's author, Matthew Aaron Goodman. Stay tuned.
Fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. Tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame, shame. Children need schools more than they need jails. And that's where our society fails. First 7 years creates a child's foundation. Mandatory for a healthy nation. And we're fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. We're tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame. How could we forget that the children come first? We left them alone and they died of thirst.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The protagonist of Matthew Aaron Goodman's debut novel, Hold Love Strong, is born to a 13-year-old mother in the bathroom of his family's small apartment. In spite of their poverty-stricken circumstances, his close-knit extended family is held together by Abraham's grandmother, whose deep faith and stoic nature carries them. Goodman wasn't to the ghetto born. He's white, Jewish, and a graduate of the elite university Brandeis. But he felt driven to take on the story of this family, to process what he learned while working with ex-prisoners in creating the Leadership Alliance. It's a community empowerment project that unites recently freed people and volunteer partners. Well, Matthew Aaron Goodman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Matthew Goodman, you're white. You, I assume, come from a middle-class family, yet you really seem to capture the spirit and the flavor of this African-American community in Queens during the height of the crack epidemic in the late 80s and 90s. And, well, I'm white, too, but I can say that you've got on your cover, you've got Nikki Giovanni, the poet Nikki Giovanni, you've got Cornel West, who give high praise to your book. So I think I can safely say that, you know, you've got a pretty authentic tone there. How did you do that?
Well, you know, I think a big part of it, or what created it, was just listening. I started writing the book while I was teaching, or after the first year I was teaching in an alternative school in Queens, New York, for kids who didn't get out of eighth grade. And it was a transitional school, and we began the school year with no resources. You know, when I say no resources, there wasn't a computer in the school office. We didn't have a phone in the wing of the building we were at. There weren't enough desks and chairs. And I was told by a representative from the Board of Education, you know, when I asked, one, what was I supposed to teach because we didn't have curriculum or books, her answer to me was, you know, when there's nothing, the teacher's everything, which to me is an untruth. I think when there's nothing, the teacher becomes a student. And, you know, I did my best to listen to and to think about the students and the students' lives, not only while they were in the classroom, but the 23 other hours during the course of the day when they weren't in the class. And I think that's how I began writing the book. And from there, you know, I spent a few years teaching in that school, in schools like it, and then I spent about 3.5 years working with men and women coming home from prison. And I think those experiences, you know, gave me sort of the opportunity to think about lives and situations outside the lives and situations in which I grew up with.
You situate the book in a time, as I already referred to it, a time that was a really difficult time in New York's black community. In the 1980s, in the early 1990s period, as I said, it was the height of the crack epidemic. Talk about that time. Why did you choose then?
I chose then for a number of reasons. One, I think, because it was such a devastating time in the life or the cycle of life in low-income communities, low-income communities, specifically urban communities. But that time also sort of mirrored the time where there was this, rise. There was the Reagan economics. There was significant economic gains in the financial sector. And I think that, also there's been a portrayal of members of the black community as sort of this association with being criminal-minded or whatever the other devious associations are related to that notion. And I wanted to sort of demonstrate the humanity of people who existed in this environment and championed each other through the difficulty of living in a devastated community.
Have you had any kind of critique or criticism from people saying that you're just looking at, you're showing a one-sided view, you're just kind of focusing on the negative, on even some stereotypes in the black community?
I think I've received actually my first, piece of hate mail yesterday. But I also know that, I wrote this book, while working with, hand in hand with men and women coming home from prison, many of whom spent 20 years, 25 years, 10 years, incarcerated. And they know what I wrote. I'm friends with many of them now. Some of them are my closest friends. They know what I wrote, and they know why I wrote the book. And so the criticism from people outside the circle of people who know me as an individual, I'm not very much concerned with. I didn't write this book to make friends with people who I don't know. I wrote this book to document the lives of people I know and love.
Yeah. So now give us the gist of the story. You have your hero, Abraham, the protagonist of the story, Abraham Singleton. Tell us a little bit about him. Tell us a little bit about his family.
Sure. So Abraham's family is led by his grandmother, who at the time of Abraham's birth is 30 years old. And Abraham's mother gives birth to him at the age of 13. And living in the apartment with him, including his grandmother and his mother, is his aunt, Rhonda, and his two cousins, Donnell and Eric, who were 4 and 2 years old at the time of Abraham's birth, as well as his uncle, Roosevelt, who's 9 at the time of Abraham's birth. So that's his immediate family, and basically his entire family, because his grandmother was an orphan. So there's no extended family beyond that nucleus.
It's an amazing scene. His mother is 13. She's, like a lot of 13-year-olds, she's denied for a long time that she was even pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
He's delivered by his 4-year-old cousin, Donnell. This is really an amazing scene. I have to say, reading it as a woman, I found it just as you have been able to kind of leap over the boundaries or the limitations of your own background, you also are able to leap over the limitations of your own sex.
The scene, I think, is a demonstration of, a couple of things. One, when I was a child, they were one of our neighbors growing up had delivered one of their children at home, and there was a photograph of the woman giving birth or in the process of giving birth in their house. And I think I was stunned by that photo as a child growing up. It's something that stuck with me for a long, long time. And then I myself, when I was born, I was born with my umbilical cord around my neck. And so the notion of being born and the process of birth is something I think that, I was constantly introduced to and reflecting on just because of, that photograph and also in my own, arrival. And then I think also as a man, that's a capacity that we don't ever possess. And I think that it's something that we have to think about. And perhaps, it's easier to avoid thinking about that as a process, as a creative, endeavor. This is the truest, most pure form of creation. This is in the end, the goal of every composer, every writer, every painter is to construct a piece of art which in some way, somehow, rivals or equals creation of human life.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit about Donnell also in this. I mean, he's very linked to the title of your story,
mm-hmm.
and that comes very much out of what happened at the moment of the birth of his brother, Abraham.
Sure. His cousin, Donnell, is Abraham's eldest cousin.
A cousin, right.
And the relationship between them is, I think, a pure relationship between brothers, be they brothers by blood or brothers by friendship or brothers by association, that Donnell takes responsibility for Abraham and Abraham's progress, and Abraham, to the best of his ability, takes responsibility for Donnell. And I think it's the struggle, that sort of struggle between each one wanting the best for each other and at the same time pursuing larger goals and being influenced by negative and positive forces, that's sort of at the heart of the novel. You know, there's this saying that I was once told, that, you know, the difference between, you know, two people, one person, let's say, going to prison and one person going off to college, is the difference between one person walking out one door in the home and one person walking out another door. And I think that's sort of the story between Abraham and Donnell, is that these are two young gentlemen who existed in the same home, but circumstances and choices had them walk out of two separate doors.
And what is it about them that had the, I mean, you say it was circumstances, but it's not just circumstances, is it?
It's not just circumstances. I think it also has to do with, you know, Donnell, I think, has a fierce sense of responsibility for his family. After the uncle Roosevelt becomes incarcerated, Donnell assumes the position of the quote-unquote man of the house, and very much too young to assume that position. I believe at the time that he assumes that role, he's 12, 13 years old. So it's sort of this notion of this young man who's forced to become a man, and in being Donnell being forced to become a man, sort of affords Abraham to continue sort of this path, this journey as a child, and to sort of seek and have the opportunity to fulfill his innate human potential, where Donnell is sort of forced into making decisions that are not in his best interest, but which he believes to be in the best interest of his family.
So, in a way, it's an unselfish act, what he does. It's his own sacrifice.
Yes. I mean, the number of men and women who I've met who've spent time incarcerated, whose decisions were related to their notion of familial responsibility, is innumerable. Mm-hmm. The young man selling drugs on the corner, 9 times out of 10, isn't selling drugs because he thinks it's cool. He's selling drugs because his family needs money, because he doesn't have a job, because there's no economic opportunity. And this is in some way the only opportunity for him. And Donnell felt in the story that was his only opportunity as well.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with Matthew Aaron Goodman. His debut novel is a superb read. It's a beautiful novel. It's called Hold Love Strong. Now, Abraham also strikes me as a very resilient child, one of these kids who, you know, there's his character as well. As much as he is protected and nurtured, there is something special about him.
Yes. I mean, I think what makes Abraham a special character in the novel is Abraham's ability to, I think, one, reflect on his life and situations, and I think also one of his blessings is his ability, his resiliency, and his ability to align himself and attach himself to people who love and care about him, and to recognize that. I think a lot of times as young people, it's difficult to recognize and to hold fast to people who champion you, and I think that Abraham possesses the sort of wherewithal to recognize who has his best interest in mind and how to hold on to that relationship and those relationships despite events and circumstances which would sidetrack or derail, you know, the majority of us.
And his grandmother plays a very important role in that.
Yes, his grandmother is, I think, embodies the notion of resiliency, and I think she instills that in all of the members of the family, you know, including, you know, Donnell, who goes to prison, and Abraham's mother, who has her problems with crack and eventually passes away. I think the one common bond everyone in the family has is, you know, despite their failings in other areas, they always find a way to be resilient.
And yet, this whole figure of his mother, his own relationship to his mother, his grandmother's relationship to her daughter is really fraught with anguish.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain point in the book where Abraham's grandmother doesn't let Abraham admit his mother back into the apartment. This is when she has, you know, fallen back into her crack addiction after, you know, attempts to stay away from it. I mean, there's a, you know, this part rang very true in the story. The grandmother is basically exercising this tough love. Mm-hmm. And of course, always the dilemma with tough love with any family that is trying to use it is the fear that the person that they're using it on is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. Tell me a little bit about how you decided to write this way. Why you decided to write it that way?
Oh, wow. Why did I decide it? I guess in some way that's a difficult question. Why did I decide to write it this way? I didn't want to be honest. I didn't want Abraham's mother to pass away. But, you know, I think that part of the story was based on some personal situations and relationships that I've gone through. And actually, you know, one of my closest friends dealt with a very similar thing. So I think in some way it was for me to process those relationships I had and the relationships my friend had, whose mother died in a similar fashion as Abraham's mother. I think that's the sort of that question is in some way at the crux of every novel is why, you know, why did we write this? Why did we write it this way? And I think that, you know, if I was able to give a concise and you know, poignant answer, I think I probably wouldn't have written a book. I think the process of writing the book was in some way trying to understand why, but I think the question for me, the question why is like this perpetually difficult and possibly unanswerable question. You know, I wrote the book because I was teaching in a place and working hand in hand with people, a lot of whom couldn't read and write well enough themselves, and I needed to process and deal with what was going on around me.
Do you think that they would have, if you had written it a different way, if you had written it in more the happy ending way, that they would have questioned that?
No, I don't think necessarily. I think because the happy ending also is something that occurs in the lives of people similar to the characters in the novel Hold Love Strong. I think the people who I know and who know why I was writing and what I wrote, I think that, you know, one of the gentlemen once told me that, you know, the gentleman's name is Mark Hunter. He said the first time he met me, he was stunned by my earnestness. And I think that's for me a blessing and a curse, you know, to be in some way earnest or idealistic. You know, I think it sometimes might turn people off, but I think it's, for me, the way I know how to live, you know.
Well, it seems that there were many choices you could have made in the book, and you seem to really make what felt to be the truer ones. Even with the ending, there is actually a happy ending,
yeah,
implied, at least in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The book ends with the protagonist, Abraham, going off to college, actually going to the college that you went to, Brandeis.
Yeah.
Brandeis University. And when it ended, he's waiting for the bus to take him there. He,
mm-hmm,
you know, he's about to start life as a freshman. And my first reaction was, oh, I want to see what it's like, you know, for him to be there. I wanted the book to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, no, somehow that wasn't quite true.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me why I felt that way?
Well, you know, the first time, the interesting, I guess, story of the novel is that the novel was sold twice to publishing houses. The first publishing house, it didn't work out. And when that draft of the novel, 50% of the book took place while Abraham was at college, mm-hmm, and navigating this new world after spending his life in the housing projects and in his community and the public school system of Queens. And then when the first publishing house situation didn't work out, I was basically in a situation and confronted with what I was going to do. And someone said to me, you know, if you're going to, as a Jewish writer, if you're going to be so bold to write this story in the voice of a young black man and growing up in these housing projects, then why don't you be, you know, put your money where your mouth is, be bold all the way. And so that's when I rewrote the novel and placed the entire book in his housing projects. And the book ends with Abraham leaving, because to me that leaving is also his beginning, and it's his birth. And it's an entirely new novel. It's an entirely new situation. I mean, he's going to be entering a world where he's a baby. How to navigate that space is something that he's never experienced or even necessarily been informed about. I guess I put him in going to Brandeis's because it was a place I went, and it was a place I navigated, and it was a place I know people and love people and who lived similar lives to Abraham. And so I guess in some way, after writing a book for 8 years, I loved the characters and Abraham so much that I wanted to put him in a place that I too had existed and that I had imagined or hoped that we would be friends, you know. And in some way, I guess I couldn't let go and say, well, you know, he goes off to some place that I don't know. You know, I wanted to keep him in a place where I was familiar so maybe I could revisit him, you know, in moments of my life and in reflection, you know.
It's so clear that you love all your characters in your book, Matthew Goodman, your book, Hold Love Strong. There are also some lesser characters, you know, who are created with a very poignant and deft kind of pen. One of them I really loved, and that was the hopeless suitor of Abraham's grandmother. Tell us about him.
Lyndon Goins is the character's name. So Lyndon Goins is probably the only character in the novel that I could say is based on someone who I knew. Before I moved to New York in 2001, I was living in North Carolina, and the job I had was I was washing and detailing cars. And one of the gentlemen I was washing and detailing cars with was this older man. He was probably in his early 60s. I mean, he had been, or you know, he told me that he had was once a boxing, an amateur boxer. And during the course of the day, he would shadow box in shadow box his reflection in the windows of the cars. And you know, in addition to telling me about his boxing career, he would always be telling me about this one woman that he loved, that he was still waiting for. And he was incredibly compelling figure. I mean, he had a deep, deep Southern accent, so it took me a while even to understand the full range of what he was talking about. But I loved, you know, one of the things I loved about that job was going and one, watching him shadow box, and then hearing his stories. So that's where that character came from.
And I so wanted him to, he does finally win her love to a certain degree.
Sure, yeah.
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 Now, this was your first novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really big one to bite off.
Yeah.
What was the biggest challenge for you in it?
The biggest challenge for me, I think, you know, and this is, I think, the biggest challenge in me in my life in general is to get over my own self-doubt. And to get over sort of the limitations or parameters that, you know, society says, well, this is how we should think or feel. So, for me, I wrote the book for 8 years. I woke up, 5 o'clock in the morning before the sun came up. And I wrote the book then. In some way, I was able to, you know, convince myself that if I was writing it before the day started, I would, you know, sort of beat doubt to the punch. So I think, you know, moving forward, even writing now, that's always my biggest obstacle is getting over the idea of whether or not I can or I can't do something. I think, unfortunately, I'm one of those people that his first instinct is I can't. And it's something that I, you know, find myself as a teacher telling kids, you know, you can't, you're not allowed to say I can't. And I think it's a refrain I tell the kids because it's one of those refrains that I need to remind myself of consistently. So that was the biggest challenge. And then, of course, being patient. And, you know, writing is a slow process. And it's one of the art forms, the few remaining art forms that's a slow process, that and painting, you know. But many art forms now, modern art forms, are so driven and fueled by technology, they're quicker, and it's growing up as a generation where I grew up on computers, it's a difficult thing at times to stay moored and respect how slow writing can be.
And in the shaping of this book, over 8 years, you say, it took you to make, what, was there a point at which you felt that you broke through to a higher level? Maybe there were many points like that, but I wonder if you could remember one.
Sure. So I think it was 2005, 2006, I was living with a young gentleman, a painter, African-American painter named Clintel Steed, who had just gone through a divorce, and another young woman, an Austrian woman who was an aspiring filmmaker. And we're living in Red Hook, way, way at the edge. Red Hook is at the far, it's on the water in Brooklyn. It used to be one of New York City's most active ports. And we're living in this building on the second floor. On the first floor, there was a bar. And on the third floor, there were photojournalists who were coming back and forth from hotspots all over the globe, and the building, you know, was very run down. And, you know, I was basically at my wit's end. I was working as a usher for Jazz at Lincoln Center, and I kept submitting the manuscript to agents, and everyone was rejecting the book. There was a few agents that didn't believe that I wrote the book, and things of that nature. And finally, there was an agent who took the book, and it was, you know, there was still work that needed to be done. And, you know, I bicycle pretty much all over the city. And so this is in some way one of those, a story about being balanced. So I went to her office and I signed this contract, and it was this huge breakthrough. For the first time, you know, there was somebody else who believed in what I was writing, who supported what I was writing. And as I'm riding back over the Brooklyn Bridge, I fell off my bicycle and broke my arm.
Oh.
But, you know, it sounds like a devastating story, a sad story, but in some way it was like this, you know, reminding me that there was still work to be done, you know, and that as excited and you know, high on top of the mountain as I felt, that it was important to remain in the middle, you know, and that's what got me to that point, and I think that's what got me here, you know. I think, you know, I grew up as a middle child, so I think, you know, sometimes I, you know, go a little too far to the left, a little too far to the right. I need to be reminded that my place is in the middle.
And what really holds you to that balance, I think, is your compassion, which is very, very powerful and really beautifully expressed in the title of the book, Hold Love Strong. What message do you want to leave people with in reading this book?
Well, I think the message I want to convey in this book, and I think in the greater scheme in my life, is that, you know, as human beings, we believe in our ability to create something destructive. You know, we believe without question that we've created a nuclear bomb, and we've done so with something, you know, you take an invisible atom and you split it with invisible energy. And I want to live a life and put forth, I guess, books and writing that says that we have the human capacity to understand and to love each other despite history, despite prejudices, despite hate, despite all those things, that if we invest ourselves in understanding, then this is a life, you know, worth living. This is why I write. You know, I don't ever want to write anything where I'm spending so much time with characters or with a story that I don't love. You know, life potentially could be way too short to do that. You know, so, you know, I hope I get to write more books. And I hope each book, you know, when all is said and done, I hope each book I write can be a testament to the fact that I believed in one, our innate human potential, and to our capacity to love and understand each other despite differences.
It's a wonderful book, Hold Love Strong. Thanks so much,
Matthew. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Hold Love Strong was named a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers book this summer. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.